Welcome to Disrespectfully Agree with Oatman and LJ. I am LJ.
And I am Mike Sweatball Oatman.
All right.
Hey! We are finally back. Had a long hiatus. Summer was nuts.
A little crazy, yes.
Hopefully that craziness will die down, but we're back.
Back and better than ever.
Well, back and as much the same as ever, at least. And we'll be talking at you this week about Once Upon a Time in...
Hollywood.
Hollywood. He got an ellipsis in there for reasons
that's
unknown.
That's a good point.
Tarantino, interesting director. What's his worst film?
That's a good question.
Many would point to Death Proof.
Oh, that's right. That is his film. I was going to say Jackie Brown, which is one of...
You know what? I did find that to be a disappointment.
I thought it was disappointing. I mean, not bad.
Not bad, yeah.
But... disappointing, especially when I heard the whole thing he was going to have Pam Grier in there and the whole thing. You got De Niro in there and you got Sam Jackson.
You got Batman
just,
in there.
Yeah, it just never...
Michael Keaton.
It never took off the way I thought it would be. That was probably the most disappointing for me. And keep in mind that I am a Tarantino fanatic. So I love his stuff. I love his directing. I love his vision. I love his dialogue. And so I guess I would have to go with that. And I didn't even hate that movie. I just thought it was probably one of his weakest movies.
It's the movies of his that I think are the least reliant on interesting dialogue are the ones that hold up the least for me. It's your Death Proofs. It's Jackie Brown, the dialogue. I mean, there's a lot of it, I guess, but it's just not that snappy.
No, it's not.
And Volume 1 of Kill Bill was fine, but for my money, the dialogue is much more dialogue-heavy in Volume 2.
I gave that a pass only because I said, and we had this conversation about some of those early Star Wars, where it was just a setup for the other movie.
Yeah.
And it was almost like, okay, I know what this is. This is almost like a filler until we get to the real to the real meat. But even for that, I thought it was pretty good because I think what he did in that.
Yeah, I don't think Volume 1 is bad.
Yeah, the dialogue wasn't good, but it looks like he made a conscious decision to fill the screen with all of these really vibrant, wonderful images and interesting colors and different gradients of film. But yeah, you're right. It's not a great movie, but decent.
So now I don't want to get into spoilers too much yet for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, but briefly, what was this movie?
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood?
Yeah, what was it?
What was it?
Yeah.
Genre-wise?
I guess.
I don't know.
I was sitting in the movie about halfway through, I just kept thinking to myself, do I not like this because it doesn't clearly adhere to any genre or do I not like it because it's just not that good?
You don't like it because it's his worst film. Easily his worst film.
It's just, there's so much, as it kept going on, I just kept thinking, this seems like a masturbatory celebration of the late 60s, early 70s, in a way that maybe he's wanted to portray on the screen all his life. Like, he's clearly a fan of that era.
It's his worst film, and I think that I know why.
Do tell.
As a writer, I've done this, and this happens, where you'll have certain concepts that are floating around in your head, certain concepts that you want to make into movies or into plays or what have you. And then at some point, a couple of those concepts combine, and then you write it as one singular piece. And then after you write the piece, you realize, no, those are two concepts that should have been different. I'm essentially trying to write two movies together at the same time, and really they're disparate movies that need to be separated and given their own attention and their own process. That's what happened here to one of our greatest screenplay writers that I've ever seen. He got caught in between trying to mix two films that should not have been put together. He should have either one made a salute to 1970s Hollywood, where you concentrated on the Cliff story and the DiCaprio story, which had its really good moments.
It did.
Really interesting stuff. And he was doing some, he should either did that and did the Sharon Tate murder separately and then concentrated on that. I think those two things got mixed in. They didn't mix together well. Oftentimes they're not together, those two stories on the screen, and then they sort of converge into an ending that I think is frankly patently ridiculous and maybe slightly disrespectful.
The ending's the best part.
I disagree. I disagree.
I disliked it enough. Or let me put it another way. I was so bored by the film that once we got to...
Something happened, at least.
Once we got to the ending, I was like, oh, thank God.
Something happened.
Thank God. There's something going on.
I respect the ending as filmmaking. And if it wasn't about a murdered woman and a murdered person, I probably would have loved it. But because it is... I just have some, and I don't say this often, I got some real moral questions in what he's doing here.
So I guess let's jump into spoilers then.
Okay.
I get the sense that he's trying to pull the same magic trick, the same rabbit out of the hat he pulled with Inglourious Basterds, where he rewrites history.
Yeah.
And Inglourious Basterds, the movie is so absurd anyway.
Exactly.
That you're like, all right, sure, why not? As a first-time viewer of that film, you're thinking, well, none of this is going to go the way anybody wants it to. And then when it does, you're just like, okay.
I'm here.
All right, good. Good on you. All right, cool. You broke the rules of, like, history.
Yeah,
cool.
You're
That's
dealing
fine.
With Hitler and Germany.
And he tried to do the same thing here. And the problem with the kind of revenge fantasy on the Manson family is that we don't have the same, obviously, relationship with them that we do with Hitler.
Well, not only that, Hitler is almost to the point of becoming almost less a human being and more a metaphor for Italy,
for
evil.
Yeah.
When you see Sharon Tate, Sharon Tate's a person, a flesh and blood person with a child in her stomach. She's not a metaphor for anything, really.
She's not even really in the film.
She's really not in the film.
I mean,
right.
She's present, but... She's a red herring for what Tarantino wants
She's
to do.
She's used as a trope for his revenge fantasy. And I don't know. I try to, and this is an unfair burden, and I will admit this. It's probably unfair. But I would wonder if that was my sister, how I would feel about that. I think I would feel some kind of way. I think that would bother me to have her sort of used in that way for what essentially amounts to a stunt, especially when you know that
it's sleight of hand. Yeah, she's the thing. She's the, like, look over here while I'm doing this.
Sleight of hand is pretty kind. I would call it a stunt and kind of a cheap one. And when the stakes are that she was brutally murdered, that kind of bothered me a little. I just kind of felt, why did we have to? You know, like the whole Bruce Lee thing. Okay, fine. I was okay.
That's the thing people have taken the most exception to.
Yeah, I get why people disliked it.
It was fun.
I thought it was fun. It didn't bother me so much. It certainly didn't deal with his death or whatever.
No.
But that ending, I was like, ugh. Something about that is just kind of wrong.
I didn't think of it that way. I saw it, what he was trying to do, and that's why he put the end, you know, the opening title card at the very end of the movie was that this is this fairy tale kind of wouldn't have been nice if everybody lived happily ever after kind of wishful thinking, wish fulfillment thing. And she is so sweet as a character in this thing, as much as little as we get of her as a character. She is very sweet and free spirited and all of that. So it did strike me as, okay, that's nice, but I can see your point of view. I don't really know how I feel about it yet from that perspective. But when you're taking historical characters, I don't know, do you have that responsibility? When you're a Tarantino, when you do take such flight of fancy, when you are such a stylist as he is, does he really have that responsibility?
I would say it depends.
Okay.
I would say it depends. I think that in a lot of ways, he took the easy way out. Took the very easy way out. What I would have liked to have seen him attempt is to do a straight movie about the Manson murders. Do a straight movie where you have to actually tell a real life story and adhere to what the facts were.
One of the best scenes in this movie, weirdly, is when one of the few times the two stories match up. When he goes to goes to Spahn Ranch.
That's the best part of the film.
That scene is great.
And it shows the promise of the movie.
Yeah.
To me, that's the promise of the movie where that entire segment where he's clearly giving us an homage to, what's the guy? But he gives an homage to a director who used to do the same technique where he would build you up, and then not satisfy you.
Mm-hmm.
He would lead you down this primrose path, get you all, and then, oh.
Although it is satisfying in a way because it's Bruce Dern.
It is. It's satisfying in a different way, but yeah. We clearly thought that Brad Pitt was about to be murdered.
Yeah, of course.
Or assailed in some way. And yeah. that he's not, I think, is brilliant
yeah.
and wonderful filmmaking. I would have liked to have seen him apply that to Helter Skelter. But, and actually portray Manson in a real way. Actually portray Sharon Tate in a real way, not as a stunt or as a trope or as a divergence for your real agenda, but actually tell that story. That's something he hasn't done. That might have been a mountain I would have liked to have seen him attempt to climb. And I would have, like I heard a rumor at one point that he was going to tell the story of John Brown. I got very excited because I've never seen him do that. Actually recount a real story and be in some ways hindered by the facts and the history.
I don't know if he'd do it. I don't know if he'd have the restraint.
But see, that's why I would like to see him try. See, I think it might be an opportunity for him to accomplish something he hasn't accomplished. Like, he's done so yeah. many things and climbed so many mountains. At this point in his career, I think it would be interesting to see him try to climb that mountain. I think he's such a skilled craftsman. I think he has the ability to do that.
Maybe.
Because they asked him what movie did he want to make that he hadn't done. I think it was on Charlie Rose. And no, he said he would love to do John Brown's story.
I think it's Star Trek, though.
No, I'm talking about this.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. And so I would love to have seen him attempt a real life story that has so much historical significance. Like, he's always talking about how a lot of the N-word and the nigger stuff that he does and the slavery stuff is he's trying to tell this story of American history, and has a responsibility to be, accurate to that. That's fine. Why don't you really take the responsibility and tell that story? That's such an important story that I don't know that I've seen any other filmmaker tackle, which is John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry, the resulting hanging that came after that, the panic that led to many black folks being lynched, such and so on. Frederick Douglass left America and hid in England so he wouldn't be connected with it. All of that stuff, I would love to have seen him take that.
That makes me more nervous than the idea of him doing Star Trek, quite frankly.
I would love for him to attempt it.
But I think Jackie Brown was him trying to restrict himself. I think that was him trying to...
Well, he's not restricting himself to a preset number of facts.
Right, but he is restricting himself in the terms of trying to adapt something, at least relatively faithfully.
Yeah, not the same thing.
As right? an Elmore Leonard fan.
Yeah, not
fan.
The same thing. A lot of people aren't Elmore Leonard fans, so they don't know if he's restricted himself or not. So nobody, who cares? But if you start dealing with history as weighty as John Brown's story, then you're going to have some real restraint on how you have to tell that story in a real faithful
and
that, way.
But that's I think the effect would be the same. Is when again, my favorite stuff of his is the dialogue. And my biggest criticism of this movie is, quite frankly, the dialogue. There are a few scenes here and there that I think are well written and fun to experience. I mean, I'm not a huge fan of The Hateful Eight, but I rewatched it recently, and you can't argue with the dialogue. You just can't.
I'm a huge fan of it. I love that. I think that's one of his best films. But
I don't dislike it. It's not one of my favorites of his. But the dialogue, I think, is fantastic.
Oh, it's awesome.
I think it's a better script than a film.
It's a great film. So
his biggest sin here, quite frankly, for me is just the dialogue is weak or not there. There's a lot of shots of people driving and listening to music.
I think in some ways we might actually be somewhere in the same place. I think the reason that the dialogue is weak is because at certain points it almost feels as though these two films are trying their best to stay together and not fly apart. It almost seems like he's doing all of these things to keep these narratives hewed together, and really they shouldn't be.
Yeah.
They need to fly apart.
Yeah.
I got a feeling.
But he's only got one more film in him, and he couldn't divide this up into two movies, man.
If he would have focused just on the cliff stuff, man, that was some interesting stuff.
And there was great stuff when Brad Pitt's up on the roof and he's trying to fix the antenna, and we flash back to him and his fight with the Bruce Lee and everything.
And I hear that scene was longer because I could have gone for it with some more.
Yeah, I could have too. And quite frankly, I hear this movie is missing whole storylines. Like Tim Roth's supposed to be in this thing.
What?
He got completely cut out of the film.
Why?
I don't know.
Once again.
Yeah.
Like I said, I would love to have seen him just cut all of that weird stuff out.
You can I need like 90% fewer shots of driving. And listening to music, as nice as the music is, and people putting on records and all this stuff, let's excise some of that out. Mm-hmm. Let's get some more of the characters, the stuff I want from Tarantino. But I think, you know, he's in love with that era, and he just wanted to. I mean, it looks authentic.
What
and all
I would
that.
Say is, I love that era too. Concentrate on that and get rid of the Sharon Tate stuff. You'll be fine.
Yeah.
Like that scene where he's talking to that little girl. Oh, such a wonderful scene. I love that scene.
That was a great scene.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Wonderfully written and interesting.
And the whole dynamic of their relationship.
Absolutely.
There's a whole story told between those two
characters
that is lovely.
Wonderful storytelling. I would like to have seen them focus that in one film, and this would have been a great film. It ended up being his worst film.
But those scenes become – those scenes, which are the things I wanted to be the meal – are really the garnish, and the meal is the flavor of the world. And I don't want just the sizzle.
Every time I saw Sharon Tate on film, I wanted to go back to the Cliff stuff and DiCaprio stuff. I wanted to go back to that. To me, that's where the meat was. I thought Leonardo DiCaprio was fascinating. I thought his character was fascinating.
And I'm not a Leo fan, and I like.
I know
him
you're
in this.
Not. I yeah. thought this was.
I liked him in this.
Very interesting. I thought I know this is cliche to say this. I thought it was one of the best Brad Pitt performances I've seen in a while. It was interesting and
yeah,
and had some meat to it. And I heard that there was some backstory.
It's very subtle.
Yeah, it was some
what he's
backstory.
Doing is very subtle.
Yeah, it was some backstory that didn't make it into the movie because it got.
Oh, I'm sure. The most we get is that very suggestive flashback to him on a boat with his ex-wife and former wife.
Yeah, but he was like a killer. He was like a ex-SEAL type of guy.
Oh, okay.
According to what I heard Tarantino talking about when he was
sure.
He was defending Cliff's ability to kick Bruce Lee's tail.
Right, yeah.
And he was saying
that was unexplained, really.
Yeah, and he was kind of explaining that how he was himself had a background of being a soldier of some sort or something like that. And I was like, man, that would have been...
It would have made that scene a little more dramatic.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That would have been nice.
So, yeah, focus more on that, Tarantino. Let's get rid of a lot of the masturbatory shots of
get rid of the
LA.
Rapist that you tend to like for some reason, driving in this wonderful car.
Wait, who?
The little rapist, Sharon Tate's wife.
Oh, husband.
Yeah.
Roman Polanski.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Roman the rapist. So right. Get rid of Roman the rapist, who you have some affinity for some reason. Get rid of him. Get rid of all of the hippie stuff with the hitchhiking and all that stuff. Get rid of that.
Yeah.
You know.
Don't need that. And there's weird stuff like.
There's only one hippie thing you got to have in this film. I love the idea that we're doing this film. And Cliff hears this rumor that his old buddy George has been taken over by these hippies who have taken over his farm. And then he goes there. We have that segment.
Yeah.
That would be great. And the rest of that you can pitch out. I mean, you can pitch out all of it.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean at the end isn't flawlessly shot. It's well done. And it's interesting. And it's classic Tarantino. My judgment isn't a cinematic one. It's more of a kind of made me feel
like should you do that?
Yeah, just feel it felt weird. I mean, he gives you all of the satisfaction you would expect from that kind of scene from him. It just made me feel a little weird, especially later when I was thinking about it. I was like, that's kind of I don't know.
If a movie as long as this one, there were some other confusing bits. Like you know, Damian Lewis.
Yeah, of course.
He was in this movie. For a second,
Damian Lewis.
He was sitting there talking to some woman we never met before at the Playboy Mansion and explaining the relationship between Polanski, Tate, and guy played by Speed Racer.
Oh, yeah, that was him. He was playing somebody. He was playing The famous guy. He was playing
I had no idea he was playing Steve McQueen.
Steve McQueen, because he looks like Steve McQueen.
I guess.
He does.
It didn't occur to me.
Right.
Like they introduced three characters from behind. Tarantino showed us three. He put little titles up of those three characters.
Yeah, I don't know how, but I knew that was Steve McQueen.
I don't know how either, because it's not till I looked at the cast list later. I'm like, oh, he was supposed to be Steve McQueen?
Yeah.
I had no idea who that was. We never seen him before. We never seen him again.
Yep.
We're introduced to him in a silhouette shot from behind. Then I don't see his face until that moment. She's like, what's going on? It just felt like weird narrative shortcuts here and there.
Yeah, that's one of those practical things he needs in that film in order to stitch these two stories together.
I guess it feels sloppy.
I wouldn't disagree. It's just sort of like, hey, let's not work for the subtext. We're just going to give it to you.
Yeah.
And those bits are shortcuts to keep these two things that don't belong together. If you break those apart, you get rid of that scene. You don't need it. You can get rid of all of that stuff.
Yeah. We don't need any Sharon Tate stuff.
I agree.
It's just there to distract.
Like the whole dirty feet and the theater thing. Somebody told me that
he loves feet.
I was about to say that. Somebody told me he had like a foot fetish or something.
He seems to.
Because he's got these dirty feet. I'm like, why is he concentrating on these dirty feet?
He does it. I mean, it was ever since I noticed it in Kill Bill. He's probably done it before then, but it was a lot of Uma Thurman's feet in that movie. Here we get it twice with Sharon Tate in the theater and then the hitchhiker putting her feet
up on the
windshield. He loves them. He's a fan. It's not my taste, but you know,
he likes dirty feet. Is that his thing?
Possibly.
Oh, my goodness.
I didn't notice the cleanliness of everybody's feet. Wouldn't surprise me. So, his worst film, huh?
I think it's a fascinating film that is worthy of study. And I think there are parts of it that are phenomenal. I just think it's his worst because it's the only one I can think of that doesn't have a cohesive story that ties from beginning to end. To me, that's always been one of his strengths, that he takes all of this craziness, but he's able to stitch all of that into a cohesive narrative that comes.
Inglourious Bastards is incredibly episodic,
but it still comes together. It comes together. This one, even at the end, it feels like it's two different films. He just never draws them together.
Yeah, even when it comes together, even if you want to say the Sharon Tate and Charlie Manson family stuff is one story, and it kind of isn't.
Yeah.
It feels more like it's Brad Pitt's story with the Manson family than it ever does with Sharon Tate.
As ridiculous as this sounds, I would be fascinated to see somebody take just a cliff and DiCaprio stuff and just stitch that piece together to see what it looks like, kind of what it might have looked like without the...
I mean, you got Pacino in this, for God's sakes, and he's in it for all of, four minutes?
And why isn't Tim Roth in the film?
Yeah, exactly. There's stuff missing. There's the longer Bruce Lee scene. There's Tim Roth. Who knows what the hell else? We need what's-his-name, Topher Grace, to re-edit this movie. Because that's apparently what he loves to do with long movies, is re-edit them down. I think he turned The Hobbit into like a two-hour film.
Well, like, from what he was talking about, the cliff stuff, I was like, man, that's fascinating. I would have liked to have seen...
Yeah, the Navy SEAL stuff.
Yeah, I was like, I would love to have seen... It actually, when he said that, and to me this is always a weakness of a film, he said that and I was like, a lot of that stuff makes sense now.
Yeah.
You know, now some of that stuff, because they hint at this volatility that lives inside a cliff that comes from somewhere. But in the movie, it just kind of comes from nowhere.
And he talks about stuff here and there, like, you know, they've been trying to get me into jail for however many years, but they haven't got me yet. Exactly. And I'm not going to get caught by you or whatever.
Exactly.
Because he seems so mild-mannered.
And almost easy breezy, easy going, but there's this darkness in him that I felt like if it had a little more, just a little more basis, maybe a scene, I think it would have gave a little
much more tension.
Yeah, much more tension to some of those. That's a great word. It would have gave more tension to some of those scenes and things that
would have even made the best scene in the movie better. When he goes to Spahn Ranch, that would have even been more tense because
we
figure he's going to die, but it's going to be a hell of a fight.
It's going to be a hell of a fight. He's a badass. But we kind of didn't know at the time what a badass he was. He's almost a trained badass.
Yeah, as it looks now, it just kind of makes Bruce Lee look like a wuss.
Exactly. Like to me,
And maybe the opinion, maybe people's objection to the Bruce Lee scene might be dissuaded a little bit, assuaged a little bit with that.
The reason that he got bashed is because they didn't do round three. If round three is in that film, you don't hear a peep. The first one, he kicks Cliff to the ground.
Yeah.
The second one, Cliff slams him into a car. And the third one, they go at it.
Yeah.
And it's an epic fight.
What if we get the like a fight like in the John Carpenter film? What's the one? The super long fight. Ugh.
Oh, yeah, you're talking about They Live.
They Live.
Exactly.
Get like a They Live fight, but with Bruce Lee and Brad Pitt?
Absolutely. An epic fight like you have with Roddy Piper and Keith David.
Yeah.
That's what it needed. Now, if you would have had that, then I think that scene would have been hailed as opposed to being slammed.
Yeah.
It needed that third round, and it almost wouldn't have mattered who won the third round. But as long as it was this close nip-and-tuck battle, it would have been phenomenal.
Could have ended in a stalemate.
It could have ended in a stalemate.
But at least you would have gotten the fight.
Absolutely. I agree. Totally. Totally, that's what it needed.
I mean, the man can fight choreography. He can do it.
Oh, my
goodness,
he
can shoot that stuff. Absolutely. He did some great ones.
Absolutely.
Why the hell not?
Well, I think that part of it is, and again, I'll keep banging this drum.
Yeah,
I think
yeah.
part of it was because you had so much weighing down the film, you just had to cut stuff because I think the picture ran about, what, 230?
At least.
Yeah, as is. So they kind of were at a point where they had to start cutting stuff. So they didn't have a 3 hour and 20 minute movie or something, you know. They start having to clip things that shouldn't have been clipped. That's the result of trying to hew together two films that shouldn't be hewed together.
Yeah. Two hours, 41 minutes.
Yeah. I figured it was about 240, somewhere in there.
Yeah.
And we would have room for all that stuff, and this may have been one of his best films, because it certainly is one of his best casts. We could have really done some work here.
Yeah, there's a crazy cast in here. You got Emile Hirsch. We don't need him. But Margot Robbie, you know, when people thought, I forget who was interviewing Tarantino and the cast, but one of them was like, so Quentin, why not give Margot more lines? And people were like, oh, come on, he's liberal, Hollywood, blah, blah, why are you harping on this? This is, you know, that's how it works, you know, movies. But now seeing the movie, I'm like, yeah.
It's a fair point.
Why not? I mean, either give her something to do or get her out or just cut the part.
Or cut the part, exactly.
This isn't, her character doesn't work here.
Fair point.
We all misjudged that interviewer. I didn't pay that close attention, to be fair. Okay. Worst film of Tarantino, although I'll have to go rewatch Death Proof. I didn't hate it.
I that's fair. I would have to rewatch Death Proof as well.
But I didn't like it.
I remember not loving it.
Yeah, I saw it, and it partially that may be because I watched Grindhouse in the theater when it was, you know, that double billing.
Yeah.
And just anything compared to Terror Planet is a relief. In any case, yeah, disappointment. Good stuff in there.
Oh, some great stuff in there.
Maybe check it out on video on demand, fast forward through a lot of the driving.
It's weird calling this worst film because there's so much good in the film.
Yeah, the stuff that's good in here is better than most films.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But, boy, it just doesn't hang together.
Nope.
And with that, we're on the Apple Podcast app, we're on the Spotify, we're on the YouTubes, the Google Music, anywhere you want to find us, you can find us. And with that, we will talk at you next week, everybody. Bye.
Peace and chicken grease.